Coming up on Fronteras, trucks bringing merchandise from Mexico to the U.S. are prime conveyors of illegal drugs.
You see it mixed in with fabric softener or laundry detergent.
As part of our Border to Border Drug series, a look at how trucking companies and law enforcement try to keep up with the evolving business of drug smuggling. And cartels thrive on the ultimate consumers. They can't stop buying the product even if they don't want it anymore.
If I don't use, I'm going to be sick, and that's a whole new different ball game there. You can't even imagine what it's like when you don't have your heroin, how sick you get.
Our entire Border to Border drug series, but first the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations. It's funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its local Journalism Center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. This week, we're taking a look into an industry that reaches every city and every small town in every state of the West. That industry is illegal narcotics. In collaboration with the Northwest News Network, Fronteras, the Changing America Desk, explores how drugs like methamphetamine, heroin, and cocaine get into the U.S., how they're distributed, and what drives the demand for certain drugs. This first story aired originally in July, but we reprise it here to examine San Diego's evolution as the principal entry point for Mexican-made meth. As Jill Replegal reports, more than 70% of meth illegally trafficked into the U.S. from Mexico comes in through San Diego.
Customs and Border Protection agents here at the San Ysidro Port of Entry face a tough balancing act.
Where are you going?
Facilitating international trade and travel on the one hand, on the other, trying to stop drugs and other illegal cargo from getting into the U.S. In recent years, they've seen a dramatic increase in one particular drug. Methamphetamine seizures at San Diego's ports of entry have risen by more than 300% since 2008. San Diego has a long and troubled history with meth. During World War II, meth spread among many American service members stationed in the Pacific Theater. When they came back to the U.S., primarily through San Diego, they brought their addictions with them, and they helped spawn a domestic meth industry. Joe Garcia is deputy special agent in charge for ICE Homeland Security investigations in San Diego.
Gangs, biker gangs, usually control the meth production and distribution. And Mexico used to provide the precursors.
Precursors being the chemical ingredients that go into meth. In the 1990s, San Diego became known as the meth capital of the country. Rampant abuse led to several high-profile crimes. There was the man who hijacked a tank and drove it down the highway, and the couple who scalded their 4-year-old niece to death in a bathtub. The damage caused by the highly addictive drug spawned a crackdown on domestic meth production. Garcia says with continued demand and restricted supply, organized crime saw a big opportunity.
Especially the Sinaloa cartel has looked at this and said, why are we the middleman? Why aren't we producing this ourselves?
Now, Garcia says, more than 80% of the meth seized in the U.S. is made in Mexico. And that's despite Mexico's own attempts to curb its production. Much of that meth comes through San Diego, in part because it's home to the busiest land crossing between the U.S. and Mexico. More legal traffic tends to come with more illegal traffic. But history and geography also play a role. David Shirk is an expert on Mexican drug trafficking at the University of San Diego.
One of the major criminal organizations working with meth has historically been based in the Pacific Coast area of Mexico, in the Colima region, the so-called Colima cartel.
In the late 90s, that cartel first established a major meth trafficking route north, 1,500 miles up the coast to the California border. Now, the powerful Sinaloa cartel controls the majority of the meth trade.
So it makes a lot of sense that this would be moving through San Diego, through the newly established or newly consolidated networks under the Sinaloa cartel, which dominate drug trafficking in Baja California today.
Most meth comes across the border in passenger cars, in ever more elaborate hiding places. On a recent morning at San Ysidro, Customs and Border Protection agents called in a mechanic to detach and then slice open the gas tank of a white Jeep Cherokee. Inside, they pulled out 23 packages of marijuana, some of them soaked in gasoline. In all, the stash weighed 52 pounds. Heightened border security has made smuggling riskier, but the profits are extraordinary, says Linda Frakes. She's an assistant U.S. attorney in San Diego.
The range is at a conservative level between $14,000 and $19,000 a pound when it comes into San Diego. And the price pretty much doubles from what that pound is in Mexico to what the pound is in the United States just by crossing the port of entry.
It's very difficult to know just how much Mexican meth is making it through San Diego ports of entry. But public health workers say meth use in San Diego County is again on the rise. Still, border authorities think part of the reason drug seizures have increased is because they're doing a better job of detecting drugs. The long lines at San Ysidro give drug-sniffing dogs time to weave in and out of the cars and alert officers to hidden stashes. Powerful X-ray machines can spot packages hidden in secret panels and gas tanks. Still, Agent Garcia is realistic about authorities' chances of finally beating the traffickers.
They're not going to go away. They're going to go do something else. But we're trying to get them to go away from meth because meth just ravages any user.
In San Diego, I'm Jill Replogle.
More than 5 million trucks crossed into the U.S. from Mexico last year. For drug smugglers, getting a truckload of illegal narcotics past border authorities means potentially huge profits. But they're often up against two levels of security, that of U.S. law enforcement and that of private export and shipping companies. In part two of our Border to Border Drug series, Jill Replogle explores how authorities and trucking companies are trying to stay ahead of the smugglers.
This is the control room of a cross-border trucking company. Dispatchers spend their days talking over the radio with drivers and poring over computer screens, constantly monitoring the whereabouts and activities of their 150 trucks.
We got it on the map every time the driver is moving, standing by, stopping a light or stuff like that. We know where the truck is at.
This is the director of operations for the company based in Otay Mesa, south of San Diego, smack up against the U.S.-Mexico border fence. The company also has offices and a truck yard on the Mexico side of the border. The company president asked that we not identify the firm or its employees out of security concerns. The company is meticulous about security measures. All of its trucks are equipped with GPS monitors. Exact routes for the trucks are established from a warehouse in Mexico to the customer in the U.S. And software tells dispatchers if a truck goes off that route or stops for more than 2 minutes. The trucking firm even hires private investigators to follow trucks at random to make sure they're not involved in anything illicit.
Is drug smuggling the major security risk?
Yes. That's the highest in our industry.
And actually, the risks here are multiple. Trucking companies have to be careful about who they're working for. A seemingly stand-up exporter could be sneaking drugs and shipments of, say, plastic toys. Or a rogue company driver could be surreptitiously working for the cartels, or maybe forced to work for them. These risks have grown along with an 80% increase in truck traffic at the U.S.-Mexico border since 1995. That's the year after the North American Free Trade Agreement went into effect. This explosion in trade means more opportunities for drug smugglers to get their loads across the border undetected. And while, at least at San Diego area border crossings, more drugs are detected in passenger cars, commercial trucks yield huge seizures, on average more than 1,800 pounds per bust last year. Here at the Otay Mesa Commercial Port of Entry, Customs and Border Protection officers process on average more than 2,000 trucks a day. And border agents have seen drugs hidden in just about everything.
In cans of jalapenos.
This is Immigration and Customs Enforcement Deputy Special Agent Joe Garcia.
You see it mixed in with fabric softener or laundry detergent.
Border agents at Otay Mesa first check a truck's manifest when it gets to the head of the line. The manifest tells the agent about the truck, who's driving it, and what it's carrying. Agents will often chat up a driver to make sure he or she doesn't seem nervous or shifty. Agents may send a truck to secondary inspection, where it could go through a giant X-ray machine or have its cargo offloaded. Several hours after we visited the Otay Mesa commercial crossing recently, agents found 1,600 pounds of marijuana concealed in a shipment of limes. If drugs do make it across the border, their likely first stop is Los Angeles.
Los Angeles is really a transshipment point.
Steve Woodland leads the Southern California Drug Task Force for the Drug Enforcement Administration.
We are centrally located to be able to push the narcotics from California in multiple directions.
Woodland helped dismantle a high-volume drug ring in August. The smugglers brought meth, cocaine, and heroin across the border in PVC pipes hidden inside the axles of big rig trucks. During the 2.5-year investigation, law enforcement seized more than 2,400 pounds of meth. That's around 11 million doses. According to the criminal complaint, the illegal shipments were coming across the border in Nogales, Arizona. Back at the trucking company's yard in Otay Mesa, a security guard runs a large round mirror with a long handle underneath the perimeter of a truck to make sure there's nothing attached to the bottom. The security guard also taps the truck's wheels with a baseball bat. Tires that have something hidden inside make a distinct sound. And the company's operations manager tells me they do extensive background checks on their drivers.
Especially if you're moving from one side to another, you got to have security in everything. And every single little thing, so.
There's just too much at stake to take any risks, he says. In Southern California, I'm Jill Replogle.
There's still more Fronteras coming up. In the next installment of our series, one case that stretches from Arizona to Washington State.
AK-47s, AR-15 style assault rifles, and they want him to run them back to Mexico. And that's when you know, these are some real significant bad guys.
That's coming up as our border-to-border drug series continues. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. Drug distributors operate an illicit export business that depends on freeways that run from California and Arizona to Canada. If you drive these freeways, chances are you've passed a car or truck secretly holding a cargo of heroin, meth, or cocaine. Correspondent Austin Jenkins introduces us to a smuggling ring that operated from Arizona to Washington State.
On January 21st of 2012, at 8:37 in the evening, federal agents intercepted a phone call.
In the way.
Go that way.
Hey.
It was between a man named Victor Berrieza Verduzco and one of his associates, a man named Jose. On this wiretapped call, according to the transcript, Victor and Jose discuss a gun with a grenade launcher attached. At one point in the call, Victor says, like the one from the movie Scarface. Assistant U.S. Attorney Vincent Lombardi.
People have seen the movie. You remember the scene at the end where Al Pacino says, you know, say hello to my little friend, and then shoots up, you know, this whole room full of people.
Say hello to my little friend!
You know, that's how they see themselves. You know, they want to live that life.
You want more?
Now, Victor's attorney says that characterization of her client as a drug kingpin is way off base. But here's what we do know. Victor, also known as Vanilla, was one of three brothers from Mexico implicated in a drug trafficking ring. They were based in Western Washington and smuggled heroin and methamphetamine from Mexico. Lombardi says the case started when a would-be informant walked into an ATF office, that's alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, and said,
I've been getting guns for this group. I think they're tied to a Mexican drug cartel. I'm in over my head.
Lombardi says the tipster's story checked out, so the feds wired him up and sent him back into the criminal organization. They obtained a judge's approval for wiretaps and started listening in on the phone conversations of the key players. Turns out gun smuggling was sort of a side business for them. Their main operation was shipping drugs from Mexico through Arizona to Western Washington.
So it was both guns going south and large amounts of heroin and methamphetamine coming north to this district, and then it would be distributed out to different parts of the United States from here.
The National Drug Threat Assessment says Mexican-based traffickers dominate the drug trade in the U.S. Federal Prosecutor Lombardi says in his experience that connection doesn't often reveal itself, but this case was different. He points to one phone conversation in particular between the oldest Berryessa Verduzco brother, Christian, who ran operations here, and his father, known as Don Victor, back in Mexico.
And Don Victor says, and I'm paraphrasing here, I don't remember the exact quote, "I just met with the big boss, Arturo's brother, Hector." Okay, well, Arturo Beltran Leyva, Hector Beltran Leyva.
As in the Beltran Leyva cartel, known as one of the oldest and bloodiest Mexican crime families. The months of wiretaps culminated in a series of raids in March of 2012 here in Western Washington as well as in Arizona and Utah. All three brothers have entered into plea deals. Two have been sentenced. Each has retained a private attorney. George Trejo represents the third brother, Yvonne.
I received payment to represent him. I don't know where that payment actually came from.
Trejo says his client was not a key player in the family drug business. His crime, accompanying one of his brothers on a drug run to Utah. In bringing down the Berryessa Verduzco brothers and their associates, the feds say they dismantled a wide-ranging international drug conspiracy. Attorney Trejo calls that puffery and bravado.
They merely dismantled this small cell here in the United States. This is a small cell.
Assistant U.S. Attorney Vincent Lombardi, not surprisingly, takes issue with that characterization.
You know, are there other people that will take their place? Sure. But it's significant, I think, for the larger organization.
And certainly, adds Lombardi, for the individuals charged in this case, some of whom will now serve lengthy sentences in a federal prison. I'm Austin Jenkins reporting.
The drug industry's evolving, as we've heard, and drug experts say heroin is back on the rise, fueled in part by prescription drug abuse. In the final story in our Border to Border Drugs series, correspondent Chris Lehman of the Northwest News Network reports on how the supply side of this business may change, but the demand remains strong.
Heavy-duty prescription painkillers have something in common with heroin. They're both a type of drug called opiates, and the effect they have on people who get hooked is similar. One difference? Heroin is usually cheaper and easier to get. That was true for Portlander Kevin Leal. He says he got hooked as a teen when he was prescribed opiates to treat chronic pain.
I was in love with it from the very beginning.
Leal says hunting for pills turned into a full-time obsession, and he eventually made the switch to heroin. It was everywhere.
Once you're kind of like in this kind of opiate world, you kind of know people that know people that know people.
Leal says he's been clean since the beginning of the year. He's now taking community college classes in hopes of becoming a drug counselor. He's also found a new part of town to live in. There's an old joke that there's a coffee shop on every corner in Portland. For Leal, heroin was actually more convenient to get than coffee.
My old neighborhood, there's probably like 7 people within a 5-block radius that sells heroin and pills.
But unlike the fiercely competitive coffee market, drug experts say heroin dealers don't really need to advertise.
They don't push the drug because this drug sells itself.
That's Lee Hoffer, an anthropologist who teaches at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio. His specialty is the heroin market, and he studies it the old-fashioned way. He just walks up to drug dealers and starts asking questions.
Yeah, it's not much more beyond that.
Hoffer says drug dealers generally rely on word-of-mouth advertising. He says, think of it this way. You move to a new town.
You're going to ask your friend, where's a good mechanic? Or, you know, what doctor do you use? And this is how people find heroin dealers.
And after a while, those dealers and other users become part of your social circle. That's what happened to Portland heroin user Linda Wickerham.
Everybody kind of watches out for each other because they know what it's like to be sick when you don't have your heroin.
Wickerham didn't come to heroin through prescription painkillers. An acquaintance offered her a dose about 4 years ago. I met her at a clinic run by Oregon Health and Science University that tries to help people addicted to opiates. Wickerham says she's come here about a half dozen times in an effort to shake the habit, but it's not going so well. I ask her, when's the last time she used?
Today. Today I used.
Wickerham says she'd really like to quit, but going without heroin has proved to be just too difficult.
If I don't use, I'm going to be sick, and that's a whole new different ballgame there. You can't even imagine what it's like when you don't have your heroin, how sick you get.
And in a nutshell, that's why the business of selling heroin is so brisk. OHSU doctor Amanda Risser says addicts routinely tell her that trying to quit involves a willpower they just don't possess.
The withdrawal syndrome is so awful and so, I mean, when folks describe how they feel when they're in withdrawal, people really do feel like they're going to die.
For Portland heroin user Linda Wickerham, the worst part about her addiction is the guilt she feels about allowing the drug to separate her from her family.
People say, you know, well, you must not want to be with them that bad because you're still doing heroin. But it's not like that. It's not that easy. But for me, that is my rock bottom, not being with them every day. Just either I'm by myself or with my friends that do heroin, and that's not the kind of life I want.
But it's the kind of life heroin producers and dealers want her to have. Because Wickerham and countless other addicts are the ultimate consumers, the kind who can't stop buying the product, even when they don't want it anymore. I'm Chris Lehman reporting.
If you missed any part of our Border to Border Drugs series, or if you'd like to share it or listen again, you can find it online at tpr.org. You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting funded journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. Fronteras is online at fronterasdesk.org. We're on Facebook. We invite you to join the conversations and post your thoughts about our stories. For headlines and updates, follow us on Twitter. Our handle is at fronterasdesk. You may subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.